Hello, and welcome to Genetics Unzipped, the Genetic Society podcast with me, Dr. Kat Arney. It's become cheaper and easier than ever before to access genetic testing, and more people are having their genomes done for reasons of personal interest, health, or ancestry. But what happens when an innocent genetic investigation reveals dark family secrets? And how do we properly engage and inform people about genetic testing and research so that they really know what they're getting into? It's been impossible to ignore the rise in direct-to-consumer and medical genetic testing over the past few years. And as the cost of whole genome sequencing falls, and the potential personal, health and financial value of genomic data rises, this trend is only likely to continue. But do people really realise what they're signing up for when they spit into a tube or squirt out a blood sample? As we head into the next decade, ethical issues like informed consent and privacy for genomic testing and research are becoming impossible to ignore, especially as your DNA doesn't just belong to you, but is also shared with your blood relatives. When Jack Nunn started doing a PhD at La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia, looking at how to involve people in genomics research, the most obvious place to start was with his own family. But he could never have predicted the secret that would be revealed once they started looking into their genes.
So I'm a big believer in get your own house in order, you know, sort out your own backyard first and talk from personal experience. So I started doing a PhD about genomics, and the working title was Genomics, Identity and Community, which was far too big and vague. However, I did think, well, I'll get my mum a DNA test because she wanted to find out who her grandfather was, etc. And she did find that out. She got some other unexpected results, though, which were quite interesting. I encouraged her to share her raw data from the DNA test on GEDmatch, which is a free sort of open source way of sharing your raw data from different services. Someone got in touch with my mum on this service and said, I think we're related. And I said to my mum, you know, be careful, this could be a scam. And then other people started popping up and we started to triangulate the data, and it turned out that this person thought my mum was their half-aunt. So this asked a few questions.
Mm-hmm.
So my mum actually discovered that she had a half-sister through this service. And so then other half-brothers and half-sisters started popping up online. This was quite unexpected. So after being in touch with a few of them, it actually became apparent that my mum was conceived with a sperm donor. So this would have been in about 1948, 1949. And this was in fact the first place in the world that sperm donation was done, artificial insemination. And it so happened that one of the people who was conceived by a sperm donor had made a couple of films about this, one called Offspring, one called Biodad, a guy called Barry Stevens in Canada. So suddenly we realized this wasn't kind of a scam on the internet. My mum was actually one of perhaps somewhere between 600 and 1,000 people conceived by this one man, Bertolt Wiesner.
Back up. So there's a guy, he's working in a fertility clinic, he's donating his own sperm, and he's made 1,000 babies.
Potentially. The records were purposely destroyed. This is a time when, you know, the legal area was very, you know, the House of Lords was saying artificial insemination was the work of Beelzebub. The clinic was run by a woman called Mary Barton. She'd actually been to India and seen a lot of families that had trouble conceiving. And of course, in those days, well, they just blamed the women. And anyone who knows anything about anything knows, of course, it can be either. So coming back to England, she worked to kind of help families conceive who were having difficulties. Bertolt Wiesner was an Austrian scientist who, in the 1930s, saw the way things were going. He didn't identify as Jewish, but the Nazis labeled him as that. He went to Edinburgh University and did a lot of the science around, you know, if you wee on a stick, you can tell if you're pregnant. That was sort of his work. They wrote a British Medical Journal article about their work, and they had a clinic that people could come. So my grandma, for example, so she went to this clinic. She used to work for the Air Ministry. When she got married, she was made to quit, and she was given something that was called a dowry payment. This is, of course, in the 1940s.
Mm-hmm.
And that was sort of about a year's salary. And basically, it was somewhere around that amount that was given to the clinic. I believe they did run a free clinic once a week for people too. And basically, the journal article said that they selected donors from intelligent stock. So we're talking about eugenics here too. And they, as far as we can tell, had sort of three main donors, one of whom was Bertolt Wiesner, another was a man called Derek Richter. And the details are not clear, so I won't speculate. But what we do know is that there are at least 20 half-siblings in touch now. And therefore, I've got potentially, you know, thousands of half-cousins. And so from starting a PhD with a working title as Genomics, Identity and Community, I suddenly find myself part of potentially the largest single ancestor cohort on planet Earth, which is quite strange.
So this is putting Bertolt Wiesner, like, up there with Genghis Khan.
You know, he's in third place.
How did it feel for your mum, for your family? Have you talked to any of the people who turn out now to be your clan?
Yeah, by a strange coincidence, I was the first person to talk to my mum after she discovered it. I live in Australia, she's in the UK, and she said, oh, I'm in a bit of shock, and my mum doesn't say that lightly. And of course, my first thought was that my mum and dad were going to be brother and sister. That's where my mind went with this, like, oh. And then when that wasn't true, for me, everything else was a relief and kind of interesting. My mum handled it very well, and not to speak for her, but we've got new family now. We've got new relations. Of course, it's different for every person. And it does ask that question, you know, how important is your DNA? And I think it's as important as you want it to be, which can be not at all or completely. And that's a personal decision. But we have been lucky enough to meet up a few times. We had an event in London last year where I met a lot of them for the first time. And in fact, just last weekend, we had another meetup.
When you all got together and met up, were there actually physical characteristics? Could you go, oh, that's Bertolt's nose. You can see it in everyone.
Absolutely. Actually, the one thing that's happened to me is I met one of my mum's half-sisters who happened to live near me. And I actually got a bit spooked when I saw her, because not only did she look a little bit like my mum, but her mannerisms were very similar. And I hadn't seen my mum for about a year. And it was a nice feeling, but it was a weird one. You know, it's that, are we just code walking around? And yes, we are, is the short answer. So what is it to be human? What is it to be family? These words are being challenged by these new realities. And I think that's what I love about genomics, is it's opening up a new frontier on understanding ourselves. And suddenly I find myself part of the group that might be best placed to help start to answer some of those questions. I used to think nature-nurture was sort of a wide open debate, and that, you know, it was fairly wide. You know, you're not going to turn into a banana, but, you know, you're fed. After meeting my genetic relatives, we have things like similar sense of humour, mannerisms are very similar, and yes, I have personal feelings about the nature-nurture debate now that are, I'm a lot more hard code than I like to think I am. Of course, it'll be a wide open debate forever, but the really interesting thing now, the question on my mind is, well, suddenly this cohort of people who are descendants of Bertolt Wiesner will of course be of interest to medical research and could potentially save lives. So my PhD supervisor sort of said, well, it's kind of beyond coincidence that you're looking at this subject and then discovered yourself to be a part of this. To not incorporate it into your PhD would be a huge missed opportunity. To say very briefly, it was, of course, ethically complicated. And we worked very closely with La Trobe University Ethics Department, who were incredibly helpful. We got it going, and effectively, we invited some of the siblings or half-siblings, to be part of an online discussion. And we used that method for a group of people affected by a rare disease as well. And basically, it's sort of asking the question, if we were going to do research with this group, how would you like to talk about how you'd like to talk about how you might do the research? So it's fairly sort of, you know, very...
Careful.
Yes, and of course, this is sort of the first preliminary stage. And what's interesting is, not to speak for anyone in the group, but there's a genuine sort of belief from a lot of the people that this is a good opportunity to perhaps help answer this nature-nurture discussion. So the next question is, you know, how do we go about doing that? And certainly with Science for All, the organization that I've started, we're looking at evidence-informed ways of involving people who have shared ancestry, which could be indigenous peoples, it could be these kind of groups. Of course, there's another group from Derek Richter as well in parallel. And I dare say, probably we are the first of many who will make such discoveries. Whether it will be as large a cohort, who can say? I hope not, but you just don't know. And it might be happening right now. People who thought they'd perhaps get away with this in the past or never considered this would be a thing, you know, it's coming, and it's coming for everybody. So for me, the question isn't how interesting this is or how this feels. It's we need to very urgently come up with ways of answering the question of how do we share power in these decision-making ways? How do we make it that, you know, yes, we are all unique, precious snowflakes, but we're also 99% similar to everyone else and a fairly uniform crystal structure. So, you know, if somebody says, oh, I don't want to be part of this, but actually you discover certain things about someone else, I mean, the obvious example would be identical twins or something. Does that identical twin get to veto their twin having their genetic test results? And
yeah, I think I did see a story about two twins. I think it was testing for Huntington's disease and one wanted it and one didn't. And I think in the end, one of the relatives accidentally blabbed the answer to the twin that didn't want to know. So I can see that if you've got lots of people out there who don't realise they're related, but actually are, this is a whole modern can of worms that humanity has never really had to deal with.
Of course, and it's coming, and with the accessibility, the drop in cost, it's coming soon. And this is why I wanted to do my PhD in this area, because I didn't see anyone really talking about this or thinking about it. And we need to be ready, and we need to be ready now. Bring into the mix legislation around insurance, employment, let's say even rising nationalism, bring that into the mix. We have a potential nightmare scenario on our hands if we don't work out our preferred realities. There are lots of possible realities. We need to collectively decide what our preferred ones are and how we share power in making those decisions so that it isn't just what certain people want.
We'll be coming back to Jack later on, but in case you'd like to know more about the incredible story behind Berthold Wiesner and his fertility clinic, we'll put some links on the page for this show on the website, geneticsunzip.com. This is Genetics Unzipped, the Genetics Society podcast. You can find us on Twitter at Genetics Unzip and online at geneticsunzipped.com. Please, please do take a minute to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It really does make a difference when it comes to helping more people discover the show and spreading the word about the wonderful world of genetics. Jack's family never expected to discover such a dark truth about their origins from a simple genetic test. Yet thousands of people all over the world are merrily taking these tests and even putting their data online. But have they really thought through the implications? To find out more about the ethical issues around the fast-changing field of consumer and medical genomics, I caught up with Anna Middleton, Head of Society and Ethics Research at the Wellcome Genome Campus in Cambridge.
The landscape has just changed enormously. Genomics has exploded into mainstream arena. So whether that's via healthcare and the new genomic medicine services that are occurring in the NHS, or whether it's via direct-to-consumer testing online. So, you know, you just do a Google search of genomic tests or genetic tests and loads of companies will come up. It's everywhere now.
Given this almost ubiquity now of the idea of genes, genetic testing, how is the public perception of this kind of technology?
Well, it really varies. And so, you know, you can walk into Boots now and see the double helix spinning on a beauty counter, and it gives an air of science and credibility. And
here comes the science.
This is complicated stuff that you should understand. But also, it can create a distance because it can make you think, well, it's sciencey, so therefore I won't understand it. And so there's an element of, well, what do I trust and what do I not trust with this? The way that genetic testing, particularly for the direct-to-consumer tests, is marketed is often about discover something about yourself, discover what you should be eating or what your exercise routine should be, or use this in your healthcare. And actually, a lot of those claims are really overstated and, you know, read the small print, because often what you'll find is that they can't really offer you very much.
There are lots of different kinds of tests you can do, from the clinical genetic test looking for specific diseases to, you know, what skincare should I have. How have these different kinds of tests caught up the public imagination?
Well, from our research, we're finding that people aren't distinguishing between the different types of tests. So a genetic test is just a genetic test, you know, whether it's for something really serious and life-threatening or whether it's for, you know, something really benign or recreational. So people aren't actually distinguishing between the different types of test. And that's actually a very important thing to go into, because if you're wanting to explore whether you have a predisposition to inheriting breast cancer or not, you know, that's a really serious issue that you can talk to your GP about and go and actually speak to a health professional about. Buying an over-the-counter direct-to-consumer test to answer that question is not the right way to go. Whereas if you're interested in ancestry or, I don't know, fitness and nutrition, then that's a completely different kettle of fish. And I would just say buyer beware and take those tests with a pinch of salt, really. They're just a bit of fun.
And one of the other things in the small print, obviously, is that it's not just your genome. Your genome is similar to many people that you're related to. If you're an identical twin, it's identical to that. And now we're starting to see more and more stories of now more people are getting their genomes done, for want of a better word. Unusual stories starting to emerge. Family secrets, misattributed parentage, I believe is the correct phrase. And for example, stories where people have gone to sperm donors or fertility clinics and have not turned out to have the baby with the parentage that they expected. Can we expect to see more of these kind of stories? And what does that really mean for people who just buy a test off the shelf and think, oh, this is fine, this will just tell me something fun?
Yes, absolutely. And even if you've never personally had a genetic test or bought a test, if you're biologically related to somebody who has, then their data will be online somewhere and it will sit in a database that's probably been sold to industry and is probably being shared around the world at the moment. So even if you're not currently having any sort of interaction about your genome, if your biological relatives are, then it can link back to you. And particularly with the ancestry sites where people upload their own family trees and they label relatives on there that they haven't asked their consent to do that. So you can then extend the kind of information that's out there about relatives. And so that's how you can track people down.
And there's kind of two things here. So there's one thing about maybe discovering, let's call them breaks in the family tree that you weren't expecting, for example, where your dad or someone's dad is not their real dad. Mm. And then also the police force is now starting to use this information to triangulate towards people's identity. Do you think this kind of information and this message is really well enough understood by the people who do choose to take genetic tests or direct consumer tests?
No, there's not enough information about the way data sharing happens and also the fact that many companies, their business model is to sell your data on. So there's much more needed in terms of transparency about the way that the data is used. But in terms of access to data sets, well, for example, Golden State Killer, which I guess you might have heard about, which is where quite an insecure database was accessed, full of genomic data from ancestry sites and things uploaded by people themselves trying to track down relatives. And this was used as the way to track down killers by the FBI in the USA. And those killers themselves hadn't uploaded their data and they hadn't had genetic testing themselves, but it was their relatives that had. And so it is possible to track people quite easily. And actually what we say now in terms of research and then taking consent for research is we say to people, we can't fully guarantee that your data won't be accessed by somebody in the future, even if it's de-identified. If your data is online, there's always a possibility that you could be identified. And, you know, people can either choose to take part in research or not on the basis of that. But I think the key thing is to be transparent. But one of the things that we're looking at in our research is whether people actually care. You know, do they mind being identified, de-identified? And what we're finding is that if people feel strongly about the purpose of the research and they see the value of genetics in helping to understand human health and disease and the links between genes and disease, then actually they don't really mind so much about the risks of identification because the value of doing the research outweighs their own personal privacy, which I think is